Hi there, and welcome to another episode of the Desi VC Podcast. This is your host, Akash Bhatt, and each week I bring you leading investors and operators investing and building diverse companies all across the globe. Yes, we've been away for a while on this podcast, but that's only because we've been building something really special for you. Come November, we will be speaking to entrepreneurs who are building companies here in the United States. With that said, I still have a bunch of episodes that have been recorded with founders back home in India, and kicking off episode number 124 is Sumeet Mehta, the co-founder and CEO of LEED, an edtech company helping digitize and transform affordable private schools to better serve students from middle and low-income groups of families. Before co-founding LEED, Sumeet was the chief executive officer at Zlearn. And prior to that, he spent 8 years at Procter & Gamble Singapore, where he was involved in brand management, leading businesses in Australia, Southeast Asia, and India. Sumeet is an alumnus of IIM Ahmedabad and PEC Chandigarh. And in today's conversation, we cover the various journeys that an entrepreneur takes personally while building a company. This is a great episode for any to-be or early-stage founder who is going to embark on a journey that is going to change their lives completely. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Sumeet.
Sumeet, welcome to the Desi VC podcast. I'm extremely thrilled to be sitting across the virtual table from you and been looking forward to this conversation for quite some time now. So before we go ahead and delve into your journey as an operator and everything that you've learned, I would like to welcome you to the podcast and ask you how your year has been so far.
Thanks, Akash. I think every year is like a new era for us, because the pace at which we are building and discovering things is just frenetic. But yeah, I mean, not too much to complain about. We've recently introduced two new solutions for schools in India, so I'm really looking forward to how they do in the market. But apart from that, yeah, it's pretty much the daily hustle of a startup founder.
That's amazing to hear. And I want to take you back memory lane because here is somebody who worked at P&G. You were a brand manager and you spent quite a good amount of time building your tools, your armory, your skills, and everything at one of the biggest brands in the world. And from there, you go to building LEED. And how does that happen? How does like a person who is mostly into consumer then think about education, and how does education kind of play a role in your life that kind of then makes it a mission for you to then think about empowering, millions of students and making education accessible to every child? How does that mission come into play? Take us through that journey, and what was the thought process when you were, even ideating this in the early days?
I mean, I would say PNG was by default. I'm growing up in India. I come from a middle class, lower middle class family. I think getting to a place where you've earned kind of the right to do what you want was really important. You got to become financially independent. So I think engineering, MBA, PNG, I would say was like the unthinking part of me, just going through the motions of what a good student is expected to do. I did that, got into PNG, and the way we are wired, whatever you put us into, you want to kind of do your best. So I think that's what really got me to PNG. But I don't think PNG was my calling. PNG was a great place to learn, I must admit. I think I learned a lot of things about myself first, because PNG is also a great training place. I learned a lot of business fundamentals in terms of marketing, brands, business. But I think in my fifth, sixth year in PNG, I started to question, like, what was I doing with my life? And given both my parents were teachers, I think my growing up years were really influenced by seeing very closely the impact a good teacher and a good education can make on someone. So it was somewhere, that seed was somewhere there. I mean, in retrospect, I can see that the seed was somewhere there. And whenever I would wonder about what do I want to do, it would always be about, I mean, I would always gravitate towards education. I was in Singapore, I would come back to India. My father was still involved in education. I would go along with him to visit some schools. And every time, being in Singapore, I could see the contrast both between Singapore and India, and the unfortunate reality that between my schooling and schooling in 2003, 4, 5, nothing had changed. So Singapore, India were at a huge gap, and India was not really moving. I think it created a sense of discontent and dissatisfaction. And after brewing upon it for some years, I finally thought that, rather than cribbing about it, I should do something about it. And that really was the driver for me and Smita to move back from Singapore to India. I, in fact, wanted to start up in 2007, but I think fate had something else planned. I met Subhash Chandra. He asked me to look at his company. So I ended up running Zlearn for about 5 years, from 2007 to 2012, which in hindsight was not a bad idea because, I had been out of India for 8 years. So coming back to India, being given the opportunity to run a company in education, I learned a lot at that point. And then in 2012, I think I lost my dad in 2009, and that kind of put a question to me that was I really doing what I wanted to do when I moved back to India? Because Zealand was a great place. I was running a company, it got publicly listed, but I think I was still serving the upper middle class, metro-based parents and students. So in 2012, again, after really asking myself the hard question on what do I want to commit my life to, I think I came to the conclusion that I want to work on democratizing really good quality education for everyone. And that's what led me to start Lead in 2012.
You're not the first founder who I've recently bumped into in the last maybe like year or two, where a lot of them talk about the true calling. And some of them have founded companies in spaces where there was opportunity, but they didn't really feel that they were truly connected to the mission or what the company was trying to do. And eventually they break away from the founding team after a little bit of time to go and do something that they're truly passionate about. Now, with you as well, you spoke about something similar, wherein education, but within education, it was trying to hit the masses as opposed to just the a portion of the society, and that became like your calling. How do you figure out what your true calling is? I think a lot of our listeners are budding entrepreneurs. They want to understand whether to look at a shiny object out there and be like, oh, cool, this AI is hot today. Maybe I should build an AI startup. Or look at something that's a little bit more personal. It may not be as sexy. It may not be as shiny. It may not actually traditionally attract the VCs that you want to, or all the glamour that's kind of like today coming with the art of company building, right? How do you look at both these instances and say, one is actually my true calling versus the other, which is something that I perhaps may be more attracted to because that's where all the glamour, shine, and fame and money and all of that lies. How do you like figure that out as an entrepreneur?
See, I think there are two parts to a question. One is how do you really identify what you want to do as an entrepreneur? And second, how do you then figure out whether it is, it is big enough to really demand your commitment for life? For
Right.
the first one, I feel that everybody has a little voice in their head which is chirping at them in terms of telling them stuff. But because we are so driven by what will get us social applause, we tend to not ignore it, or sometimes even suppress it. I did that. I think when it was time for me to choose between engineering and humanities, I wanted to do humanities, but my father was very keen that I first, quote unquote, secure my life, right? And I suppressed it. I did 4 years of engineering. To be honest, I hated it because I didn't have any interest in it, but I did well. Which is the irony. So to any budding entrepreneur or wannabe entrepreneur, I would say that listen to your heart. I think we know in our heart what we want, but we don't listen to it. We suppress it because we're so driven by what will give us applause, whether it is within the family, society, peer group, batchmates. All of those external things end up driving us much more, and we end up not listening to the voice in our head. If we listen to the voice in our head, most often than not, it'll guide us in the right direction. That's number one. I think the second thing is that once you listen to the voice in your head, that is where then you should end up bringing some pragmatism, which is that some ideas are just hobbies, some ideas are pastime, some ideas are part-time gigs. One has to ask the question that is the problem that is calling you large enough to create a really big outcome? If it is not large enough, it can become either a pastime, a hobby, or even a lifestyle business. It will not become a venture-backed large business. So the beginning has to be from the heart, and then the choice needs to be from the head. And if you can flow between these two without worrying about what people would say, more often than not, you'll end up at the right place.
But does it have to be a venture-backed business?
It's a choice. I mean, that's why I think a lot of people choose a lifestyle business, which is a single member firm, a small firm. And I mean, it really depends on what you want to do. And you know, and that's why I said, if you listen to your heart and say, okay, I want to basically just do this, and I'm happy running a small office or running a 10-member team, or I'll see where it goes, that's perfectly fine. But if you really want to commit your life and you want a certain outcome, then I think you need to also ask the hard question that is it large enough?
Yeah, so it's a little bit of like heart plus commerce that kind of needs to go and blend hand in hand before you make that decision. And if you don't want either one of those, then the outcome is probably going to be very different.
True. And you need to be okay with that and not worry too much about what people would say. And I think in a society like India, we tend to worry a lot about what people would say.
Yeah, how did you shut off that noise in the early days?
I don't know. I think, I mean, my dad used to tell me that I'm wired differently. He used to use this phrase. He said, "You have divine discontentment. You always are dissatisfied with the status quo." As a child. So maybe I think I was wired. I got lucky. I was wired differently, or maybe because I was the youngest child out of three, I had to kind of fight my way to get accepted. I don't know what happened. Something happened in my childhood which made me really be the rebel in the family or the person who would not listen to elders. And I carried guilt around that for a long time that, you know, is there something wrong that people always say, ye sunta nahi hai. But I think after a while, I then realized that it's okay.
This is a very common trend that I've read about in human psychology, which is a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of like leaders associate a lot of their present day success to a lot of the struggles that they've had as children, as when they were growing up as kids. And more recently, even in the Walter Isaacson book that he wrote about Elon Musk, which probably came out like a week and a half ago or so, he talks about the struggles that Musk had when he was a younger child as well. It's that innate restlessness, that urge to like somehow prove himself and be that rebel that kind of like kept driving him a little bit more. As you're trying to like figure out who you are as an entrepreneur, of course, you've got a million things that are happening around you. You're fundraising, you're building a company, you're hiring, you're figuring out GTM, product market fit, you have stakeholders to like answer to. How much time do you spend reflecting back on who you are as an entrepreneur or who you are as a leader? Because that is one of the things that I don't know if it's one of those things that you need to think about early in your journey or later in your journey, or is it a or is it even just a something that is a place coming from a place of privilege? When you get to a certain point in your journey as an entrepreneur and journey of a company, you look back and you're like, okay, cool, I've raised a little bit of money, company's like stable. Now I'm gonna reflect back on who I am. What's the right answer? Like, when did you start reflecting back on who you are? How do you want to be as an individual? How do you want the company and the people within it to reflect and look back at you and be like, okay, this is who Sumit actually is? How much thought goes into personal growth?
I mean, it's a really deep question that you're asking, and I think it's a really important one too. I have seen that, you know, as a child till the age of 14, 16, we are literally growing up unthinking because we become a reaction to what elders in our life tell us about ourselves. Like if somebody tells me you are intelligent, I start believing that. If somebody says you are shy, I start believing that. So teachers and parents and elders play a large role because You're fairly unfiltered when you're accepting feedback as a child because you know your own self-identity hasn't fully formed. And now that I am in education for the last 16 years, I've also studied child development, brain development, so I can kind of combine the two and reflect both on my own growth and journey, but also as we work with children to work with teachers on what they should and shouldn't do. I think if you re if you see in Hinduism, there is this process of Janeu, which at about 14, 16 years. And as I look back, I think there is a thought process that that is the time when you can choose who you want to be, because till then you have just been a reaction to what has happened to you. So I would say that, you know, at about 16 is because your brain is fully formed, your synaptic connections are fully formed. That's a good place to start, although that is not the thing that teenagers would worry about. So they would wait till about 24, 25. For me, it happened, I think, after I met Smita, because all our life we are basically seeking approval of somebody. When you are a child, you are seeking approval from your parents or teachers, elders. And when you become an adult, you are seeking approval from friends or the opposite gender. And when you get it unquestioned, you start to feel a little settled in who you are. So I think, I mean, it's a syrupy answer, but I think love plays a big role in kind of settling you, because you realize that somebody else is okay with who you are. And till then, you've always fought this question that, because, I mean, is the reason why I'm not getting acceptance in a group because they are not okay or I am not okay? I think you got to get settled with who you are is okay. Whichever point in life you get settled with the issue that I'm okay, that's when I have seen the true journey begins, because then you are really focused on what you love, what you want to do, versus trying to do things to seek approval. Now, the earlier it happens, the better. I think we are at our end trying to bake it into the education system that we are building. But for each person, I think this is perhaps the most important thing that they would do in their life. And I wish for people to do it sooner than later, because, you know, the moment you do it, you realize, oh my God, I wasted my life till this point.
I echo that. I feel that this journey, the 9 months that we've been building, I feel I should have started a long time ago, because the learnings that I've had in just this little short period of time feels like everything that I've probably done for the last like 13, 14 years of my career. Like post engineering, I feel I should have just done this, because I'm like, I think I wasted 14 years. I probably have learned so much in the last 9 months.
True.
But not to discount any of the things that have happened in the past. It's just that this journey teaches you so much. And more than it teaching me about company building, it's just taught me a lot about myself. It's taught me a lot about my insecurities. It's taught me a lot about how I look at other people. What is my temperament? How do I negotiate? How do I talk? How do I present myself? All of those things you take for granted sometimes, because in a work environment, it's very different. When you're representing a small company which has no customers and nothing, it's an idea on paper. It's a very different ballgame altogether. And that journey for me has been very personal. And more than the outcomes, yeah, sure, we've raised a little bit of money, we have customers and all of that. Outside of all of that, I think I've just relished getting to know myself better. That I feel that journey could have happened much sooner. It would have been much better had I known myself better earlier on than making all the mistakes that I did along the way. So I'm going to pose a very similar question to you that I constantly ask myself, no matter what journey I'm on. How do you discover your insecurities as a founder, as an investor, as a leader, as a mentor? And then how do you then make sure that you're not also at the same time walled by your own biases?
This is not an easy one. I think we are wired to have biases because that's our survival mechanism as human beings. So the only way out is just to become more aware. See, I think I mean, I have done work on myself because whenever I've hit a wall, either in terms of not knowing what to do or struggling with choices, I've gone inside to find out answers. So like I follow a meditation practice called Vipassana. I got introduced to it because I was seeking answers after I lost my dad, because it wasn't a great phase of my life. And I think what it told me was that ultimately, I mean, the basic principle that everything is impermanent, so don't get attached. If you can be equanimous in joy and sorrow, then I think you are able to deal with the situation that you are dealing with versus dealing with the emotion towards the situation. I think they are two very different things, right? So, I mean, I've been again fortunate that I got introduced to it, and it has basically allowed me to become more aware of what is happening within me when something happens around me. And I'm able to catch myself. I'm not always successful, but very often I'm able to catch myself from reacting, because reacting comes from, like, the type one brain, and responding comes from the type two brain. And if you are able to respond, you're much more effective. Now, the only way I've found is that when there are conflicts, or when there are setbacks, or when there are situations, I tend to really be brutally honest with myself and ask, hey, like, what's really going on here? And I think then listen to the answer that emerges, because you know from inside what you're doing, but then you're also playing a game with people in front of you, and sometimes with yourself. So if you can be brutally honest with yourself, to acknowledge what is happening, then you are able to deal with it. I have seen it happens with practice. I wasn't like this 15 years back, but I think with practice, I'm becoming better. I mean, there's still a long way to go, but I'm becoming better.
While you were saying, treating equanimously both these things, it kind of reminded me of one of my favorite poems called "If" by Rudyard Kipling. I'm sure you would have, read it or at least heard about it, where he says, "If you can dream and not make dreams your master, and if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, and if you can meet triumph and disaster and treat both the imposters just the same." It kind of like reminded me of that because I think it kind of is a good North Star in some way to know that there are going to be ups and downs no matter what journey it is, life, building companies. But again, staying true to who you are is a very difficult journey, and finding yourself in that journey is probably the hardest thing that one can do. And I've really enjoyed like getting to know this side of you because you don't necessarily come across a lot of founders who are able to like share a lot more about just personal, how they think about things and what are things that are very close to them and near to them. What is their thought process? And that's one of the things I've really enjoyed in the podcast more than anything else related to, like how do you raise money and all of that stuff? Because that information's out there. A lot of people will obviously bring that out. But this is one of the stuff that founders don't talk about enough. And I think we should get more founders because it's a very difficult journey. It's not as easy. We only talk about the glam stuff. We don't talk about the stuff that happens behind. I'm sure in the process of raising hundreds of millions of dollars, working with thousands and millions of customers, bringing all that revenue in, there's a lot that you have probably like endured, and sure the people around you who have endured as well. So flipping the question again back to you, as you have discovered yourself and you have probably gone from the 0 to 1 journey and then the 1 to 10 and probably on the third leg of your journey now, what have you learned about yourself that still surprises you? And two questions. One is, what have you learned about yourself that still surprises you? And second part of that question is, as you evolved from, being the doer in the early days to now becoming an enabler, how hard was that shift mentally for you?
I think the thing that I have discovered about myself, which continues to surprise me, is that I mean, all every step up in my journey has been a function of coming to accept myself, some part of myself. So, for example, I was told that I trust people blindly, or I trust people a lot, and I was told it in a way that it is a bad thing. And I struggled with this thing that inherently I cannot create a environment where I am policing or checking, because that doesn't come naturally to me. But when I was not sure about it, I used to toggle between police trust, police trust. And at one point I realized that I think 95, 96% people are good in this world. There are always going to be 2 to 4% who would take advantage. Now, am I going to live my life worrying about the 4% and in the process not building trust with the 96%? That's not a great life to live.
Agreed.
And I decided to give up my guilt or question about that. And that actually has really helped me. Then I was told that, you know, I sometimes don't think about the details. I basically push people for big goals, big ideas, and it tends to burn people. And, you know, I should be more pragmatic. And I again used to carry guilt when people would say, oh, we don't have work-life balance, or, you know, I don't think it is possible. You're just being unrealistic. And then I realized that ultimately, you know, if I was realistic, then we would not be doing lead. I mean, I would be still in PNG. I was told by everyone when I left PNG that you are being stupid. You know, who leaves Singapore and PNG, comes back to India, and anyways, right? So I think it's about, I have seen that different facets of me, which I have not been sure about because people have told me something, to come to accept it, that it's okay, we'll deal with the consequences and move forward, has just opened up new vistas for me. Every 2-3 years this happens, that there is a setback, people will say 10 things, I would absorb, think about it and say, either, I mean, sometimes I accept because they are good feedback. And then sometimes I would say, no, I don't think this is me. And again, like I said, going back to listening to just yourself and knowing what will give you joy and what will maybe give you results, but you won't feel happy. So choose the former, not the latter. I think that is the journey in terms of self-discovery. To the second question about how did I move from doing it myself to it wasn't difficult because see, this was not the first time I was working. I mean, in PNG, I was leading large teams. So I had gone through that journey in PNG. Then even at Z, because I was the CEO, I was leading large teams. So I think setting up ambitious goal, aligning everyone, inspiring people, figuring out what's to be done comes naturally because now I've done this for didn't come naturally and I had to learn was hiring, because you know in PNG there is a system that takes care of it.
That's right. Yeah.
And even in Z learn, but in lead, because me and Smita started as two people, so I think I had to learn to build a little bit of critical evaluation in my thinking during hiring, because the trust part used to come earlier and I would be fairly, I would say, non-discriminating in hiring early on. I don't think I'm still perfect yet. I still make mistakes in hiring. That's one of my weakness still. But again, learning, reflecting and moving on is what we're doing. Yeah. So yeah, the second part has not been a big challenge, to be honest.
Yeah. Would you say that's been probably the toughest part of, you know, being on this journey, is hiring one of those things, or is there two or three other things that you've probably discovered along the way where you feel, okay, this is not something that I was good at, or I can get better at, or perhaps Smita was better positioned to like take care of things on those lines. What was the hardest part of your journey?
I would say, I mean, the biggest mistakes that we have made and I have made is hiring. I think I tend to like most people. And then I have to ask myself whether they will really do what is required and be there for the long term. Over the last 11 years, I think slowly, slowly, I've now created a framework in my head in terms of what will work and what will not. And I think my big learning is the biggest filter for leadership positions is, do they care for the mission?
Mm.
Because no startup journey is easy. It is bound to have ups and downs. So while there is up, everybody rejoices, right? But when there is a down, those people who only join because they see a big ESOP valuation, or they see wealth creation, or even sometimes they see just adulation for being part of a startup,
part of a company,
they will leave. They will lose interest. Those people who really care about, okay, you know, we're doing something great in education, we want to make a difference, they will stick out.
Yeah.
And every dip is followed by a rise. And I think that's my realization. So now, if I ask somebody, why are you interested in lead? And they're like, I have done corporate for like 15 years. I want to do a startup, I think edtech is a great sector, kind of stuff. I tend to discount those. Now, 5 years back, I wasn't doing this, so it has been a painful learning journey, this hiring. I still don't think I'm perfect at it. I'm getting better. But what has helped in this journey over 11 years, Akash, is that Smita and I have very complementary skills. Like Smita's detail orientation has actually helped us in a lot of times, because I'm not that detail oriented. She is. And I think also being a couple and being co-founders has helped, because I think as co-founders, you need to, I mean, co-founders are literally married, because the amount of trust they need to have, where each of us is taking decisions when the other is not in the room, and the other person knows blindly that,
They'll come through.
they're moving the company and in the right direction. I think that has been really, really helpful in us doing this together. So yeah.
That was going to be one of the questions that I would pose to you is how is that dynamic between, a real life couple and them being, teammates, colleagues at work translated? And has that been some sort of a journey that was organic, or was that there was a lot of learning that kind of like had to go through? I asked that because one of my portfolio companies, in fact, they're co-CEOs of the company. It's called Third Love. It's a very interesting sort of, they're a lingerie company here in the US going after Victoria's Secret. They've been around for like past 10 years. They have a very different equation. And when I asked a similar question to them, they're like, we had to figure a lot out. Like we knew each other before the company. And then, it was really a learning process for us to figure out how we work together. We'd never worked together. We'd known each other. It's a different dynamic altogether. What was that journey like?
I think again, in this regard, see, Smita and me both met at PNG. We used to work together, and I had a lot of respect for her work. And now I'm assuming she had the same. Because she was in finance, I was in marketing. So these functions are the typical, they would fight with each other, and we used to fight too. And so 8 years in PNG, I think in the first 2 years, we used to work on the same brand. But then when we started dating and then got married, of course, we were working on different businesses, but we were able to see what the other person was doing in their respective business. So I think before we started working together, there was a really, really healthy respect for each other as professionals, not as husband and wife. And then we also knew that what I am good at are some of her opportunity areas, and what she's good at are my opportunity areas. I keep saying, I think I've been really fortunate in a lot of different things in life, and this was another one where both of us were very complementary, and I think trust was again a given. So a lot of people have asked me, it must be tough that you spend all your waking hours together, don't you need time away from each other? We have not. Again, it might sound very syrupy, but we have not faced a challenge. Yeah, I think the only challenge we faced was at one point when we started working together. Smita told me that now that we're working together, I am having to run two jobs because home and work, and you have only one. And we need to have a fair allocation. So then at the home front, also, we divided between me and her, as we had done at the work front. So I started taking care of the kids, education, and she started taking care of the home. And then at work, we had split work. So then it became like truly 50-50 co-founders at home and at work. And it's worked out beautifully.
That's a very interesting we can probably spend a lot more time just figuring out how that dynamic kind of like plays out. Well, we've got about 10 minutes here, so I want to be mindful and I want to cover a couple of topics before we what I think will be, and I hope it can be the first part of many parts, because I've really enjoyed this episode. I want to do like a part two as well. I would love to understand some of the non-negotiables for you, because I'm sure over this journey, you've kind of like, as you were saying, discovered a lot about yourself, the frameworks that you put into place to keep yourself in check. What are some of the non-negotiables for you today? One, from yourself, and two, from people that you work with.
See, I think for me, I like to flow. I don't have a lot of shoulds in my life, and that might be counterintuitive. But the only thing I'm committed to is getting excellent education to more and more kids. And I'm in a frame of mind where whatever it takes, we would do it. Of course, I think something which are given is that it has to be legal, it has to be ethical. All of those is a given for me. I don't see them as choices. I think they are given. But in terms of, what kind of school to work with, what kind of products to launch, I'm basically realizing that the more constraints you put, the less your opportunity set becomes. And if there is a very simple articulation of your mission, which is there are 270 million kids in this country, in my lifetime, if I can get to 100 million, I would consider it a life worth spent. So that's really what I'm committed to. I think people who work with me and even myself, see, I think both me and Smita, we're terribly hardworking. Like I keep telling people, apart from our two kids and Lead, which is our third kid, we don't have a lot of other things going in life. I mean, any free time I have, I would be reading, but I don't have any other indulgences. So, from people, I also kind of expect commitment to the mission. Now, it doesn't mean that 24 of hours of their life they're spending thinking about this, but if people don't care about the mission, it doesn't cut it for me. That I think is the one thing I would expect, because otherwise, and then the corollary is that if you care for the mission, then you will do what it takes, because it is an important one. You can't care about providing good quality education to kids and then not do a good job of it. Whether you are developing curriculum, whether you are developing product, whether you are selling to schools, whether you are driving implementation, it'll show up in each of your so work. And therefore, if I don't complicate things, if I either hire people who care for it, or after they have come, I work on igniting that spark, the rest will take care of itself.
I love that answer because it's one of it's probably the hardest thing to also judge in a candidate or judge within people is it a mission that kind of like fuels you for a long distance? Is that marathon that kind of like fuels you, or are you there for like that short sprint? Because you can get highs from both. Like being a runner myself, I can tell you that there's a high that you get doing that 5 to 10K, but there's a high that you reach when you're at that 32nd kilometer on a 42 kilometer like marathon run. You're like, shit, this is the last. I love them really. Now that thing is like really kicking in. So it's diff so and you have two different sets of people who walk into the door when they want to work at Lead. It's the people who are in for the short sprint and people for the long haul. And both their missions probably kind of like are aligned. You can't really say it's not, because people who are there for the short term as well, 3 4 years, but if they're committing to 100% every single day towards that short term mission, it's time well spent. Because you have, as I was saying, people who are 0 to 1 people who will then move on and become 0 to 1 people at a different company, because that's who they are. They're 0 to 1 people. And then you have people who are the 1 to 10 people who really know how to like take the company from whatever A to like maybe like C or D and beyond and stuff. And then you have the last leg people who kind of like come in, right? How do you as an entrepreneur, you as a leader, you as the face of the company, then try to assess maybe flipping that switch and making somebody who's a short distance runner a long distance runner? How do you like make them buy in? Like what do you do? I'm not talking about just culture, but how do you really like get them to like buy into the mission of, hey, you're not here for just the short haul. I know you came in with that thought, but this is a longer journey.
See, I think it is fairly organic, I must say, that at the hiring level, I think we are able to get like 20%, 25% people who really care for the mission and who join. And then there are people who, after they have come in, they see who we are, what we are doing. There is a switch in the heart. The most I've seen is if somebody walks into a classroom or a school and sees what is happening and then compares it with schools otherwise or their own education, they would more often than not feel like, oh, this is something worth doing here. I mean, if I'm able to get these 40 kids interested and engaged in their learning, which otherwise would not be happening, and I'm earning well, and I have a wealth creation opportunity. It's like the best of all worlds, right? So I think there are a lot of people who then after joining start to see the intersection of doing well for themselves and doing good in life. There are some people, you know, for whom they see life not as a series of 5-year climbs. They see life as 2-year sprints, and they want to move because there is X percent high or there is a new shiny thing. We're trying to have less of those. It is unavoidable. I think internally, what at least I am driving is that if we can get to like a 70% of our people being missionaries and the remaining 30 are mercenaries, that's fine. I will never get to 100%.
Yeah.
But that's what we're aiming for.
That's nice. I love that. I love your perspective on that. And, you know, parting thoughts. If you were to like go back and build and do this journey all over again, what's the kind of advice that you would give yourself for the journey that you're going to probably embark on over the course of 11 and a half years building Lead?
I must say before I answer that question that I firmly believe, and I have now started believing, earlier I wouldn't, that I think in Hindi it says jo hota hai acche ke liye hota hai, right?
Mm-hmm.
I believe that where I am is where I'm supposed to be, because it is a series of a million small decisions that, you know, one would have taken over the last whatever years that we are working. So to want or desire anything else is actually wanting what you don't know. So I'm okay where I am. I think I want to just put that caveat. Now, in 2012, when we started Lead, I don't think we had any inclination that we'd be here. Any inclination. We just thought we are unhappy with how education is happening for small towns and low income families. Let's do something about it. Let's open a school. And we opened a school. And then after running 5 schools, we realized that this is not going to scale to a place where we can have a really large scalable impact, because max we'll have 30, 40 schools in our lifetime. So we decided to work with already existing schools. I think I would tell my 10-year younger self 2 things. One is put a lot more thought in hiring and get the right people together. I don't think I put that much thought. I was fairly reactive to what was coming our way. And second, I think we got wedded to the product that we had built for too long, because I used to always say that you should be focused on the problem and solution and not the product form that is solving it, because product forms can change. But I think we fell into the trap of falling in love with that product for, I think, 2 years longer than it would have needed. So the 2 products that we've launched this year, I should have done it 2 years back. Because we were getting feedback from the market, but we were thinking people are not understanding us. And I've learned that customers are always right. You should listen and change versus trying to convince them.
Yeah.
So those would be 2 big learnings, I would say.
That's fantastic. And I've really enjoyed having this conversation with you. And as I was saying in the middle part of the podcast, I'd love to do a part 2. I know we're unfortunately short on time here. I've truly enjoyed speaking with you. And I say that from the bottom of my heart. And second thing, and I've probably not said this to anybody on the podcast, I've related a lot more to you and your journey than I have with anybody who's been on the show. I've done about 140 guests on the show, but there are a lot of things that you mentioned that reminded me of a lot of things that I've either been through or I'm going through. So outside of this, I would love to, you know, keep in touch with you, get your thoughts from time to time on some of the things that I'm enduring, both as an individual and as that of a founder. So if you don't mind, I would love to connect with you beyond that. But I'd love to do a part 2 with you at some point of time, if that's possible.
Sure.
And we can delve a little bit more into it.
I don't think I have spoken about my personal stuff so much with anyone, because mostly conversation is about business, Lead, and people.
Yeah.
I would love to both stay in touch and if time permits, do a part 2 whenever it's the right time.
Would love that. And on that note, I'd like to conclude this one, but then looking forward to doing the part 2 sometime really, really soon. Thank you again for your time.
Cool. Thanks, Akash.